record to the cloud. Okay. Good evening and happy Hanukkah to everybody. So our topic for tonight is American Judaism in the age of the Great Immigration from Eastern Europe. And we're going to discuss not only the religious fate of the new immigrants, but the broader American Jewish community, and to see how this differs dramatically from what was before 1881, and to see where things are headed and if we can find any indicators as to what would happen after World War I, because developments will be underway leading towards the denominational divide that we are familiar with and which we discussed at great length 3 years ago. Okay. So traditional Judaism and traditional Jewish observance was in steep decline after the Civil War. In 1879, an organization came about called Kayam de Shemaya, which literally means to Lekayam, to observe the dictates of the Shemaya of heaven. It was founded to give Judaism a boost and to revitalize and reinvigorate the Sabbath and to bring back the anti-assimilationist holiday of Hanukkah. Hanukkah was essentially a non-factor in the life of American Jewry in the 19th century. We've got to bring it back because it teaches us that we can't be mityavnim, we can't assimilate completely into the ways of the heathens, but rather we have to preserve our distinctive Jewishness and Jewish religiousness. So those who were involved in Kayam de Shemaya tended to go on to have illustrious careers in American Zionism and in eventual conservative Judaism. So even before the Great Wave, there were those who saw that Judaism in America cannot survive if everybody goes the route of religious indifference and radical reform, that something has to be done to bring us back to our roots. In 1893, three different organizations were established in the same year, all which in the long run would help benefit Jewish education, to give people some content, some tochen of Jewish awareness. One was Gratz College, which educated educators, who would go out into the field and teach in the Talmud Torahs and the Cheders. Also the Jewish Chautauqua Society, and the National Council of Jewish Women, which would give scholarships and educational grants that people should not be ignoramuses, but rather should learn both secular and in the holy. Among the bizarre features of American Judaism out west was the existence of a female rabbi who was not a rabbi, but was nonetheless an important religious preacher and sermonizer. This was Rachel or Ray Frank. She was known as the girl rabbi, or the female Messiah, and she was out west in Spokane, Washington, and in other cities. She was born in San Francisco, and she didn't have a radical message. It was a fairly conservative message, and she believed in, you know, the primacy of motherhood, and when eventually she married her husband, she stopped giving drushes from the pulpit. But she believed that the Jews of the West had essentially run away from their heritage and needed to be reinvigorated in Yiddishkeit. So, yeah, that's, you know, an unusual situation of a woman from the pulpit long before there were female rabbis. But it should be noted that Judaism, and especially Reform Judaism, was becoming very feminized. The home, the synagogue, and philanthropic social work were all regarded as the proper domain of women. And as for the menfolk, they basically were not around. They absented themselves from religious life among the Americanized Jews. This was also true among Christians, that the church was becoming a very female institution, with the men disappearing in large numbers. Okay, so the Orthodox Sherith Israel, because it was an old-time synagogue and had Americanized clientele like, you know, the Reformers did, they also established a sisterhood in 1896 for the loyal conservation and transmission of religious values. So it was understood that you need the ladies of the congregation in order to give a little Yiddishkeit to the next generation. That if the ladies are not cooperative, if you leave it only to the menfolk, there'll be no children who are Jewish. The ultimate expression of this eventually would be Hadassah, founded in 1912, which, although it's a Zionist organization and not an inherently religious one, was nonetheless the chief Jewish outlet for many women in the early part of the 20th century. Okay. So the Reform sharply split from the traditionalists in the 1880s. A few weeks back, we mentioned the Trefa Banquet of 1883 at the first graduation of the Hebrew Union College. And then in 1885, there was an intellectual battle royale between two very important New York rabbis. One was Alexander Kohut, the other was Kaufman Kohler. Alexander Kohut was a major scholar who had just come from Europe. He was a Hungarian, and he graduated from the JTS of Breslau, and he was a believer in moderate reform, positive historical Judaism. He came to Anshei Chesed in Manhattan, and he gave a series of lectures in the summertime, Pirkei Avos lectures, in which he espoused a more traditional kind of religion than the reformers would have thought was appropriate. And the response to that was from Kaufman Kohler, the leading ideologue, the son-in-law of David Einhorn, to basically say, no, the reform way is the correct way, is the Emes Lamito. And so this Kohler-Kohut imbroglio led to two things. On the reform side, it led to the writing of the Pittsburgh Platform, which we spoke about at some length before. On the traditional side, it led to the founding of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York in 1886, in January of 1886. In earlier lectures, we've gone through the early history of the seminary at great length. If you want to read the authoritative book on that, I would recommend A Different Spirit. This is the title of the book, A Different Spirit, about the early history of JTS. Or if you get your hands on the very thick volumes of Tradition Renewed, this huge two-volume work, the first few chapters deal with the history of the seminary, including the early history, in which the seminary was a catch-all institution for everybody to the right of reform. It was a combination of the Orthodox, the German Orthodox who were in America, and the middle of the roaders, the historical school, who could collaborate so long as they're teaching Torah for the sake of educating potential rabbis who are not going to be reformed, but rather are going to stand for a more traditional and intense form of Judaism. Okay, so the Reform, they understood that they have a problem on their hands. If they want to sustain the attachment of their people, and it's not even their people, it's just the mass of American Jews who had been in the country for a number of decades and had basically assimilated, they had to give some identity to these people. And so it had to be not just we're negating things, but rather we're upholding things. And Kohler believed in God, and he wanted to dispel notions that reformers are all a bunch of agnostics or atheists. And so in the Pittsburgh Platform, it made important reference to religious beliefs and not just disbeliefs. Also, there was a tendency in the decade to follow to move past the old approach of Israelite or Mosaic faith or Hebrew and come closer to the term Jew, that the term Jew was no longer going to be a dirty term, but rather a term of endearment. But what about the Eastern European mass migration? Once these people come in large numbers, American Judaism is going to change forever. It's not going to be any longer the 250,000, Sephardic and German and German Jews of the 19th century. It's going to be a totally different community. Well, American Judaism is going to change, and we're going to have an influx of traditional people. But not necessarily because the leading traditionalists of the old world thought it appropriate for Jews to move to America. In fact, some of the leading figures said, you can't move to America, it's treif. So in the most famous of these was the Chafetz Chaim, so Yisrael Meir Kagan, the author of the Mishnah Berurah, probably the leading rabbinic figure in late 19th, early 20th century Eastern Europe. And he said, don't go to America. If you have to go for business reasons, stay for only a short while, and then come home. So do not stick around in America. In his book, Nidche Yisrael, he wrote about this at some length, trying in homiletic form to convince people that they ought not go. But he was not the only one. The Ritvaz, Rabbi David Wolofsky, who was a famous rabbinic writer, wrote a commentary on the Yerushalmi. He also said, Don't go to America. Even the Stones are treif. Of course, what happened to him? He ended up in Chicago, okay, where I guess the Stones weren't as treif. He also ended up at KJ briefly, having a run-in with Mordechai Kaplan at the pulpit on the High Holidays of 1904, 1905, which, again, was something we spoke about a couple of years back. So there were the rabbis who said you can't go to America, but there were also rabbis who said you can go to America. And who were those rabbis? So among the more famous was Yisrael Salanter, who died in 1888, but in the last decade of his life said it was perfectly fine to go to America so long as you do your best to maintain your religious attachments. And we'll see that his disciple, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, becomes the first chief rabbi and the only chief rabbi of New York. The other one and most famous to say it's okay to go to America was Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan Spector, the chief rabbi of Kovno and the leading posek of Eastern Europe in his time. Now, why should it come as no surprise to anybody that Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan would say it's okay to come to America? Because, what? Yeah, who knows the answer?
The yeshiva is named after him.
The yeshiva is named after him, exactly. We wouldn't be naming the yeshiva in America after somebody who said it's treif to come to America. But that's not really true, because the Chafetz Chaim said it's treif, and they named the Chafetz Chaim yeshiva. Ah, what happened? So he said it's okay to go to America, and not only for the lay people, but he said, Bedafka, the rabbis should go to America because the lay people who went in large numbers and are basically amaratzim, ignorant and don't know all that much of Talmud and Halacha, they need guidance. They can't be bereft of spiritual leadership. So therefore, his Talmidim were the Orthodox rabbis of Eastern Europe who got on the boats and went to America. And when the Agudas Rabbanim was founded in 1902, predominantly they were the disciples of Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan, and the yeshiva was named after him in 1897 because he died in 1896. Okay. Now, plenty of people who moved were already not very religious, and moving to America made them even less so. The stories of throwing tefillin overboard, you know, from the side of the boat, were not merely apocryphal. Legend has it that it really happened. but I actually don't doubt that sort of thing did happen, that the boat experience really was a major shock to people. They were not just among Jews, they were among Gentiles also, and among other Jews who were not as religious as they were. And so people did cast aside previously held convictions while en route. The question in the chat, what case would an anti-immigration rabbi say to the victims of pogroms? So you're, it's David from David Simrat. So that's a very good question. So what would the anti-American Ashkenazic rabbis of Eastern Europe say to those who had suffered from the Cossacks and elsewhere in 1881 or 1903 or 1906 to say, you know, stay back here in Europe? The answer is there's no real answer about personal safety and security. The only talking point is that if piety was really that important to you, you wouldn't risk it in the treif land, or a land where you couldn't guarantee that you could live the life of a Ben Torah. So there's no good answer about the pogroms, but there's just this idea of we fear religious downs, you know, backsliding more than anything else. Okay. Now, there were pockets of Frumkeit in America when people arrived in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s. But people who encountered these pockets of Frumkeit and were appreciative that they existed quickly realized that whereas in Europe, the piety was ubiquitous, and most people, at least where they came from, were observers of the commandments, were Shomrei Mitzvot, that in America, the Shomrei Mitzvot were the fringe minority, that you have to find a few like-minded people who still care about Chol of Yisrael or this or that or the other ritual detail, but most people just don't care. Okay. Now, there were three types of immigrants. There was the pious immigrant who was willing to sacrifice for faith, meaning, I'll give up my job rather than be Mechalel Shabbos. I'll go hungry rather than eat something of dubious kashrus status. So you name it. Many, many areas of religious law which come into conflict with late 19th and early 20th century urban living. And so what do you do about it? Well, if you're a real holy roller, you'll make great sacrifices for faith. That's one category of immigrant. Another category of immigrant is known as the Schwitzer. Who's the Schwitzer? So the Schwitzer is willing to do anything and everything to get ahead in life. That he'll reject religion, he'll sell his grandmother for a nickel to get ahead in life. And from our perspective now, the issue is just the issue of Judaism, of religion. It's a non-factor to the Schwitzer. If it has to be discarded, it'll be discarded so that I can advance material in the new world. The third type of immigrant is the radical free thinker, who has ideas about the proper social order or the proper reordering of society, and that things must be done in the political realm to advance this agenda. And so my own personal enrichment is not as important as revamping society in the utopian image. So what was the average Jewish immigrant? Was he category one, two, or three? The answer is a little bit of all three. Your average Jewish immigrant had some religious scruples, maybe even more than just a little. He sincerely cared and didn't want to have to break the halachot that had been important to him or her in the old world. But they wanted to get ahead. And to the extent that it was possible, so you'll cut a few corners. And they also had ideas about the way society should be, and that the worst vestiges of Tsarist Russia or the worst features of modern-day American capitalism ought to give way to something a little bit more enlightened and progressive. So most immigrants had a little bit of all three in them. Okay. What about religion? So the rabbis had no official standing in America. There's no ecclesiastical hierarchy here that's recognized by the state, but rather it's every man for himself. Okay, because of this, it was not easy to sustain scrupulous attachment to the mitzvot, but it was very easy to abandon religion altogether because the rabbis no longer were watching you and obsessing over your every move. Whereas in Europe, there was penalties, social ostracism for violating popularly accepted religious rules. In America, such things didn't really exist. So, were there any real rabbis of standing in America in the early wave of the immigration? So in 1887, Rabbi Moses Weinberger wrote a memoir, a famous memoir of Rabbi Weinberger, in which he claimed that there only were three or four real rabbonim in New York. And when he says real rabbonim, he doesn't mean just that they have smicha, but rather that they are gedolim, who can answer questions in psak halacha. He says, maybe there are three or four. So that's not very many, considering at that point, New York Jewry was pretty big. Probably over 200,000 Jews lived in New York at that point. So this means that it's a backwater in terms of Talmudic scholarship. Well, the Jews were sheep without a shepherd. The rabbis made small salaries, very small salaries. And usually it wasn't enough to make ends meet. So they left the business and they would go into business, some kind of other line of work. When rabbis from Europe would inquire of their colleagues who were already in America in the 1880s, 1890s, should I come to America? No, Moshele, should I come to America? The answer is stay home. You can't make parnassa here. As an honest rabbi. So why was that true? Why was it that you couldn't make parnassa as an honest rabbi during the Great Wave, at least in the earlier phases of the Great Wave of immigration? So a few reasons. One is because Eastern European Jews were not accustomed to paying for their rabbis. You know, the government paid for rabbis in Europe, especially in those countries that had a formal, legally recognized rabbinate. So either the kihila, the community through communal taxation, or the government itself paid for the rabbis. You didn't have the individual Jew needing to cough up dues to some institution, some shul. Okay, that's one point. Also, some Jews harbored long-standing grudges against rabbis. This is something that ought not be dismissed and overlooked. This is actually a very important point. Some people who came to America, and not just some, probably a significant number, had a bad experience with the clergy back in Europe. And that may have been a reason for them to leave and go to America, whether because their halachic status, or in terms of mamzerus or something else, or halalim, or kohanim, was dubious. Whatever it might be, there were plenty of people who didn't like rabbis because of a bad prior experience. But also, there's a problem on the rabbi's end. The rabbis had to learn that they were not the shtat rav, the rabbi of the city, but rather, what were they? They were merely an employee of one shul. And that's not an easy pill to swallow for someone who, back in the old country, had been accustomed to the idea of the glory, the kavod of Avraham. Everybody in this town has to recognize me as the gadol hador. You know, no, you're just an employee of one shul. It's a big come down. Now, some lay people went into the fake rabbinate. Like, the fake news is the fake rabbinate. What is the fake rabbinate? So what can you do as a fake rabbi? Who knows? What can you do as a fake rabbi?
Well, what can you do? Shochet.
Huh?
You can do shchita.
Oh, well, okay, good. Shchita. So shchita requires, kabbalah. You have to get a certificate of approval either for ophos, for birds, or behemoths, whether small behemoths or large behemoths. So there are different types of ordination, so to speak, for shchita. But if you show up in America and claim, I'm Rabbi so-and-so, who comes from some village you never heard of 10,000 miles away, yeah, and I do shchita, then with no verification whatsoever, all of a sudden he's killing animals and calling it kosher. That's one thing. What else can a fake rabbi do?
Give a speech.
Bingo. Okay, you can
marry people.
Okay, good, sehr gut. Okay, so you could be a darshan. Now, the truth of the matter is, even back in Europe, you could be a darshan without any real credentials. It's just that the Jews in Europe were more learned, or the communities on the whole had more learned members. And so if you were a complete phony and charlatan, it was hard to get away with it. It wasn't impossible, but it was hard to get away with it. In America, everybody is an Amaretz and doesn't really know all that much. As long as you can string a few sentences together in Yiddish, citing supposed Talmudic passages, you could be a darshan, you could be a preacher. Okay, but also, and most importantly, you could marry people. Okay, you could be a marriage officiant. So, now, in some jurisdictions, you required some authorization by the state, but typically you didn't. I mean, nowadays in New York State, you don't need to have any verification of who you are. It's a good faith thing that if you're a clergy person, you can officiate weddings. Only in New York City, in the five boroughs of New York City, is there a roster of names. You know, my name is in it, so is 10,000 other rabbis' names in it, you know, anybody who has a shul. But for the most part, it was basically a free-for-all. So if you claimed you were a rabbi, all of a sudden, you could be doing solemnizing weddings. But what's the problem if a complete charlatan is solemnizing weddings? What might happen?
Mamzerim.
Okay, what else?
They want to get.
Okay, so a lot of things could go wrong. And that's why the Talmud says, it's a Gemara in Kiddushin and Gittin, that if you don't know what you're doing when it comes to marriage and divorce, don't get involved. That's the Talmudic guidance. So what could go wrong? First of all, the ceremony itself might not be done correctly in terms of the tabat, the ring, and the Ede Kiddushin and the Ede Ksuba. You know, just, the guy could foul up the service, which happens even today, even with people who are supposedly competent. But also, people who shouldn't not lawfully be able to get married, at least in the eyes of halacha, might be put together by this marriage officiant as a phony rabbi. You know, a mamzer to a regular Jew, or a kohen to a grusha, or a kohen to a gioret, or a kohen to a chalal. You know, you'll have all sorts of permutations that are not kosher in the eyes of the halacha that a fake rabbi would say, okay, fine. Also, if it's a phony baloney rabbi, then if the marriage ever comes apart, will the people know to go to this person for a get? This guy doesn't know getin, you know, from anything. He couldn't tell the difference between a get and a chalitza. So,
do the people really care?
So a lot of people didn't care, which is why the fake rabbi can get away with what he can get away with. If people cared, they might be more attuned to ferreting out those who don't really have credentials. Okay. Now, many American Jews seem to like the latitudinarianism, which is a fancy word for saying the hefkervelt, the free-for-all, and the absence of rabbinic intrusion in their religious lives. Meaning, I'll do what I want to do, and I won't do what I don't want to do. And no rabbi is going to boss me around and manipulate my religiosity in a way that I'm uncomfortable with. In 1900, approximately four-fifths of New York Jews were unchurched or unsynagogued. That's a lot, four-fifths, 80%. Only 25% of men on the Lower East Side went to shul regularly in 1904. Now, although only 25% went regularly, that's not to say that nobody, you know, most people didn't go at all. No, in fact, most Jewish men did go to shul at least occasionally, whether for yahrzeit or for high holidays or some special occasion. It's just that they were not a regular attendee Shabbos after Shabbos or day after day. Now, what about fraud in the kosher business? So Paul Rutt wrote in the chat that there's the great kosher meat war of 1902. Yes, so the kosher meat wars and the fraud in the kosher industry was a big problem. Only 40% of those who claimed to be selling kosher were honestly selling kosher. That's a tremendously low number. That's horrible, horrible. That 60% of the supposedly kosher vendors were selling treif. Well, that's what certain statistics, which were compiled by the field researchers at the time, concluded. That means that among the real pious, there was a great reluctance to eat meat. If you were among the real holy, you would shecht your own animals, or your own chickens, because you didn't trust anybody. I remember my teacher at YU for Yoredeya was Rabbi Weiss. And he said back in the old days, but for him, the old days meant like the 30s, not the 1900 or 1904. But he said, my family, we only shechted our own chickens. We didn't trust anybody. So it's true, there were people who were real pietists who didn't trust anybody because there was rampant fraud. Okay, well, there was a problem with Shabbos observance and going to work. So as Len says in the chat, Saturday was a regular work day. There were no legal protections in those years. That's true. So an employer would often say, if you don't come in on Saturday, don't bother coming in on Sunday. To which Homer Simpson famously said, woohoo, four-day weekend. But, for the Jew of 1903, it's a real problem. It's a real problem. Okay. Well, in some shuls, there was a priority given to Shmiras Shabbos. And certain shuls would be named Shomrei Shabbos. In Boston, there was a shul called Shomrei Shabbos, and half the people were Mechallel Shabbos. So it goes to show you that even among those who wanted to do the right thing, it was extraordinarily difficult. In all the American Jewish history textbooks, where they talk about Sabbath observance and the challenges that Jews faced, they give the example of Harry Fishel. Now, Harry Fishel was a big macher in the Orthodox Jewish community in New York, was a major donor to YU, I think was the father-in-law of Rabbi Herbert Goldstein. You know, he was a big player. He was considered the Eastern European Jacob Schiff, and the Orthodox Jacob Schiff, a rich guy who gave tremendous boatloads of money to worthy causes, Orthodox causes. So he tells the story that he was a young man in America, and he kept quitting his job every Friday because he couldn't find one that would let him off Saturday. And what happened? Finally, he says to himself, I'm going to have to go to work on Saturday, but I want to daven first. So, So Norman says in the chat that the Hashkama Minyan comes from those who worked on Shabbos. Exactly. So Harry Fishel went to Hashkama Minyan on a Saturday, and he had an epiphany. He said, this is the davening. This is what matters to me. I can't go to work. He had every intention of going from shul to work, and he said, I can't go to work. He quit his job and then struck it rich in another business later on. Okay. Well, in 1913, 60% of the stores on the Lower East Side were open on Saturday. 60%. That's terrible. But Azoy Gate, you know, that's what it was. People needed Parnassa. They opened up the store. There was nothing stopping them legally. There was only maybe social ostracism among the pious for having a store open on Shabbos, but that wasn't the world in which you lived. And among your social circle, it was considered acceptable, at least grudgingly, to open your store Saturday. So people did it. Okay. There was a trina, you know, a woman's prayer. The women have trinas that they say, supplications, supplicatory prayers, that a woman would say, she would daven that her children should have good parnasa. Why? So they shouldn't have to be mechallel Shabbos. So not to have good parnasa so you could afford a fancy house or afford a fancy car, but good parnasa so that the children don't have to become mechallel Shabbos. That was the tchina. Well, what was the role of women in preserving, or for that matter, undermining religion in this environment? So women brought modernity, but they also preserved tradition. How did they bring modernity? So number one, in luxury or labor-saving devices, appliances, convenience items that people were obtaining as the 20th century moved along. And this brought a measure of change into the way the household functioned. Also, some who could afford luxury items brought it into the house. So the women were bringing in things that, that the family didn't have before, representation of material success. On the other hand, they ruled the kitchen, and the kitchen was a dominant feature of Judaism, kashrus, ethnic foods, ethnic folkways. So the woman is both the preserver of Judaism and the wrecker of Judaism, potentially either direction. But what about going to shul? Did women go to shul? So whereas by the Reform and the Christians and the church, the house of worship was predominantly female attendance. Among the Orthodox synagogues or the immigrant synagogues of the Lower East Side and the ethnic neighborhoods of the second settlement areas, it was 60% men, only 40% women. So the shuls of the Eastern European Jews were not like the Reform shuls and not like the churches. It was mostly men, and the women were behind a curtain somewhere. Okay. So the Landsmannschaften. The Landsmannschaften, which we've mentioned before, so Eli's asking, did women cover their hair? The answer is some did and some didn't. A little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. It happens to be the case, but I'll answer your question more directly, that among the Litvishi Rabbonim, the Lithuanian rabbis who formed the Agudas Rabbonim, it is absolutely the case that many of their wives did not cover their hair. This was, of course, not true regarding Hasidim, who would come later, or for that matter, other groups, the Pilesher, the Glitziana, but among the Litvishi Rebbetzins, it was very often the case that they didn't cover their hair. So, the Landsmannschaften, they brought people together with camaraderie on the basis of Yiddishkeit. But when I say Yiddishkeit, I don't mean Judaism. I mean Yiddishkeit, Jewishness. Now, why Jewishness rather than religion? Because religion could be a divisive thing. You know, I believe in God, you don't believe in God. I keep Shabbos, you don't keep Shabbos. I put tefillin, you throw the tefillin overboard on the boat. Religion can divide us terribly. But Yiddishkeit, Jewishness, that ties us all together. So if you want to get along, Chaim wants to get along with Shimon, in the Landsmannschaft, they can talk in Yiddish, they can speak about generalities and the struggles of America without having to get too much involved in the weeds of religion. Okay. Well, the two foci of American Jewish life for the next 100 years would be, on the one hand, Judaism and faith, and the other is Jewishness and peoplehood. Already in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, we see that there's a sort of a bifurcation, and this will continue going forward throughout the 20th century in ways we will discuss in subsequent lectures. Okay, now I want to read to you a description of how a Landsmannschaft society went about becoming a shul, because this often happened. The question was, isn't Jewishness that encouraged burial societies? Absolutely, yes. They often started just as Chevra Kaddishas and then would morph into other things, mutual aid societies and maybe eventually a synagogue. So let's read, how does a Landsmannschaft become a shul, or at least develop a synagogue component to it? A few individuals, usually such as came from the same town or district, feeling the necessity of some concerted action, banded themselves together to form a beneficial society, ordinarily bearing the name of the town or district whence most of their members came. The aims of such society, in the first instance, was to assist financially any of the members who might be sick, to provide burial for the dead, okay, Norman, that's burial for the dead, a death benefit for the widow or orphan of a deceased member. After the society became strengthened in numbers, a hall was hired for meeting purposes and was converted into a praying room. With the approach of the high holidays, a season when every Jew feels the need for a synagogue, a reader was engaged and seats sold to members or non-members. This brought a considerable revenue to the society, And after a few years, in many cases, the organization saved enough money to begin negotiations for a synagogue building. So that's the, you know, by hook or by crook, how a Landsmannschaft might become a shul. All right. Well, so sometimes these Landsmannschaften, they would bring over a rabbi or a chazan or a shochet, a clay kodesh, from the outer heim, from the old hometown, to make it seem more authentic. In other words, if you're the Bialystoker Shtiebel, then get a rabbi from Bialystok, get a chazan from Bialystok, or fill in the name of the town. I just use Bialystok because that's where my family came from. But it's more authentic if your clay kodesh really is from the place where the name on the window. Okay. Well, these Landsmannschaften were not Kahal Kadosh. You know, remember when we first discussed the early synagogues in America, and there was Kahal Kadosh Beit Elokim, and Kahal Kadosh this, Kahal Kadosh that, holy communities. So Kahal Kadosh implies that this is the community, the Jewish community of the whole city or of the whole region. But the Landsmannschaften, even when they formed into shuls, they were consciously not Kahal Kadosh. They understand we're just a little group here. We're not the whole community. And so what do they call themselves? Chevra. What is a chevra? A small group. The people, a chevra. That's what it is, a chevra. Okay, so that's what it was, a chevra kadisha, but not a Kahal Kadosh. So even among the irreligious, there was not a complete loss of old world religious culture. What am I talking about? You know, even by the free thinkers and the socialists, Saturday was still called Shabbos. It wasn't called Saturday. And Yiddish was still written in Hebrew characters. Abe Kahn, who was the publisher of the Forward, before he had the Forward, he was writing the Arbiter Zeitung, the workers' newspaper. And every week, he wrote a column, a Dvar Torah. It was called the Sidra, like the Sedra, the Parsha. And the first few lines were actually about the Parsha. And then he would go on to discuss how socialism is found in the Parsha. So it was a socialist Dvar Torah every week, but it was based upon the Parsha. So here, even the Goyish Yidden were learning Parsha. Okay, well, and he called himself the proletarische Magid, the proletarian Magid or preacher. So a question comes up. Why did kashrus in the home survive longer than certain other rituals? If I were to ask you, you know, granted, there was a lot of fraud, but put the fraud aside for a moment. People sincerely wanted kosher meat. A lot of people, not just the real holy roller Shomer Shabbos types, but even plenty of people who were not all that frum wanted to keep kosher in the home. Why?
I would think it was ingrained culturally upon generation to generation.
Okay, good. What else?
Have you said tradition?
Okay, yeah.
It was healthy.
It was healthy. All right. Good answer. So there are three answers that the scholars like to give.
Sometimes what? Generations lived with each other.
So bingo! Good job, Tina. That's the right answer. Okay. So one explanation is warm maternal memories of the old kitchen. That mama kept kosher, so we want to remember mama, so we keep kosher too. But the second one is multi-generational households, and even if not living in this under the same roof, you have family that are coming and going out of the apartment, or friends coming and going of different religious madrigot levels than you are. But if you dumb it down to eating chazer in your house, then can those people eat in your house anymore? No, they can't. So you don't want to alienate from commensality, from table fellowship, your close family members. Therefore, do the smart thing and keep kosher at least at home. You want to eat shellfish out in the restaurant? That's your business. But back at home, you got to play it by the rules. Now, lastly, there was distinguishing ourselves from the Gentiles. You know, they eat the pork and they eat the schmutz. We don't eat that. We're better than that. So even if you didn't think it was like that God wanted you to do it, but we're better than them, the heathens. Okay. High holidays, many Jews went to shul. and many shuls opened up. And they opened up even in saloons and burlesque halls. Inappropriate venues for tefillah became, at least under exigent circumstances, a makom tefillah, place of prayer. And tickets were sold, and people came in large numbers, and there was, people were mercenary rabbis and mercenary chazanim who made parnasa by selling tickets and rendering their services. Sometimes these mushroom synagogues, as they were called, actually were fake. The tickets were sold, and people would show up, and there was nishken chazan, nishken rabbi. There was nobody there, and someone walked away with a lot of money. Okay, so why did people go to shul on the high holidays? So sometimes even a free thinker would go to shul on the high holidays. And I'll give you a classic story of someone who otherwise would never go to shul, but he walked past the synagogue on the days of awe, and he heard the sounds of the cantor, and he had to walk in because of happy childhood memories and sweet like child faith. So he said, I went not in order to pray to God, but to heal and refresh my aching soul with the cantor's sweet melodies. And this had an unusually good effect on me. Sitting in the synagogue among lamplight and listening to the good cantor, I forgot my unhappy weekday life, the dirty shop, my boss, the bloodsucker, my pale sick wife and my children. All of my America with its hurry-up life was forgotten. In other words, for a brief moment, this guy had menuchas anefesh, had tranquility, living in the old world for 5 seconds, listening to the chazan. Okay. Well, in the other direction, there were those who went to the Yom Kippur ball. And there was a most famous Kol Nidre ball in 1890 that all the textbooks talk about, the Kol Nidre ball of 1890, that people wanted to stick it in the eye of religion so much that they said, on the holiest night of the year, we're going to go eating and drinking and carousing and dancing just to stick it to religion and to a God they didn't believe in anymore. Okay, but most didn't do that. Most never had that kind of antagonism towards religion. Most Jews, even if they were not pious observers, wanted to at least be deferential and respectful to the holiest days of the year. Okay. Now, there was also folk religion. Folk religion to keep away the demons and the devils. So give me an example of what you do to keep away the demons and the devils. What do you do?
Poo, poo, poo.
Poo, poo, poo. What else?
Garlic.
Garlic. What else?
A red thread while you're sewing.
A red string. Okay, the red string. Good. So in American Judaism of the 1890s, 1900s, superstitious aspects of folk religion often survived a lot longer than did real religion. In other words, the details of Judaism, as appears in the Mishnah Berurah, although the Mishnah Berurah didn't exist yet, but in the Shulchan Aruch, okay, so that went by the boards. But folk religion, to keep away from the devil, that survived. However, very important, we should remember, it only survived among the immigrant generation. The Native American, the American-born second generation, tended to regard this as stupid, and they dropped it. You know, like a hot potato. So it didn't last very, very long. Well, people, wanted to have mitzvah observance. They were relaxed about the details of that observance. For example, if you had to have a bris, and the bris was supposed to be on a Thursday, but you got to go to work Thursday. So what do? When do you make the bris? When is the bris? Sunday, you make it on Sunday, or you're getting ready for Shabbos, and there are people coming, 10 people coming to the apartment for a big dinner. So you can't cook on Shabbos. You have to have all the preparations done on Erev Shabbos. Oh, but candle lighting. If you have to keep cooking for another half hour, keep cooking another half hour. So the details of religion gave way to convenience. What about bar mitzvah? The boy has to have tefillin, but he's never going to wear the tefillin again. So what do they do? Instead of buying a new pair, they would buy an old pair or a fake pair. What's a fake pair? What's a fake pair of tefillin?
No kosher.
Right. Instead of cloth on the inside, what do you have on the inside?
Nothing.
Paper. Fake. Okay. By the way, for a long time, the majority of the pairs that fill in on the Lower East Side were fake. Many people who were bar mitzvahed in the 19 teens, 20s, 30s never had tefillin from their earliest days. It's unfortunate, it's sad, but that's the way it was.
What about mezuzot?
Mezuzot were very common. Jews did not give up on mezuzot so quickly. In fact, even Arayom Hazeh, even the very irreligious Jews will have a mezuzah. So why does mezuzah stick around?
So the good luck charm.
Right.
Three reasons. One is the good luck charm, but there are two other very important reasons.
Protection.
It's cheap. You only do it one time, and you leave it there. So it doesn't involve a lot of effort or financial expense. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, very often, you didn't have to put it up at all. It was already there. Why was
The previous tenant.
The previous tenant was a Jew. The landlord was a Jew. And you're a newcomer, a greenhorn. It was there when you got there. Okay.
Freaking Judaism.
So,
it's like that in South Africa.
Death. Death becomes an important part of American Jewish life. Okay? American Judaism doesn't survive without death. That's what the joke that they say, except it's not a joke. It's true. So why is it that for people who were gradually slipping away from traditional observance, that the life cycle rites pertaining to the funeral, to death, were of special importance, that they preserved even longer? Why?
You want to cover your bases.
You want to cover your bases. That's true.
Your family in the cemetery.
Okay, so... Very often it was the case that people respected their parents more in death than they did in life. And for two reasons. Kibud Av V'Em, Yaakov Avinu went to Lavan. For how many years was he with Lavan?
20
years. He was away from Yitzchak for 22 years. And he didn't do Kibud Av V'Em for 22 years. Esav was home, did Kibud Av V'Em. All right, so people left Europe. They left parents behind. They never saw them again. It was a traumatic experience, and they felt in some ways guilty. They couldn't take care of elderly parents when they were on their deathbeds. Here I'm living in America. I'm in my 30s, my 40s. And it's 1890 or 1900. And my 70-year-old mother or father is back in wherever, in Poland, in Russia, and I'm not taking care of them. So there's guilt over the lack of Kibud Av V'Em. Alternatively, both parent and child were in America. But what happened? The parent was a Fruma Yid, and the kid wasn't. And that tore the kishkas out of the parent. And the kid understood that I caused my parents such aggravation all these years. At least upon their death, let me do the right thing and be frum about it. So many people fell into that category. And so that's why Shiva and Shloshim and Yartzeit survived a lot longer than many other things, which technically speaking in Halacha are much more important. Most of the funerary rites are only minhagim or dinim derabbanan at most, not Torah laws. And yet, American Judaism is not about the real hierarchy of Torah law, rabbinic law, custom. It's about just whatever happens, happens. You know, there are sociological reasons for why certain things survive and certain things don't. Okay. Well, the funeral directors started playing a big role in the life of American Judaism by the 1910s already. And this is certainly true today. You know, we're going to discuss this at some length. In a few weeks' time, we're going to review a book by Jenna Joslett, The Wonders of America. And it's about material culture, material Jewish culture in America, 1880 to 1950. It's a great book. Maybe in about 4 weeks from now, we'll go through that book in some intensity. And it talks about certain characters in American Jewish life who play an outsized role. The caterer, the photographer, the funeral director, certain of these, you know, these professionals who are not Jewish professionals per se, but end up dominating our life cycle occasions. So we'll get to that eventually. Okay. So, now. The problem was that the Orthodox Jews were allowing their kids to grow up with very little Torah. Very little Torah. The boys went to cheder, maybe, and if they went to cheder at all, they finished at the age of 13 for bar mitzvah. The girls had almost no Jewish education at all. By 19, it was estimated that approximately 75% of all New York City Jewish kids had no formal Jewish education. None. That's three had no education Jewishly. In the mid-1880s, upwardly mobile Eastern European Jews, many of whom had come to America before the Great Wave, would come in the 1870s, on the Lower East Side, built or moved into cathedral shuls. So big synagogue buildings. Which shuls am I talking about? Can you name one?
The Allostone.
Well, at that time, not yet. That would be a little bit later. But you're right. So Beis Medrash HaGadol on Norfolk Street, Olav Tzedek, and Eldridge Street, Kol Hadas Yeshurun. Not to be confused with Kol Hadas Yeshurun of KAJ of Washington Heights, that's later on, but it's the same name, Eldridge Street Synagogue. So these lavish buildings sometimes were built from scratch, sometimes were bought out from a church. The focus was on decorum and appearances. No talking, no spitting, no bustling around like you would in a school. It's the high church of Judaism. What's the point of all this? Well, if you're wealthier, but you haven't left the old immigrant neighborhood, you want to show your material success and your cultural refinement by having your house of worship be different from just a primitive shtiebel. You want it to look good. You're imitating what? You're imitating the Reformed Jews had their big cathedral synagogues and the church, okay? So what is a famous aspect of this cathedral synagogue era? The Chazanus craze, the big Chazanus craze, where people, where Chazanim were brought over from Europe for thousands of dollars to be paid to sing, exhibited contradictory cultural ideas of tradition on the one hand and modernity on the other, spirituality versus material success. The service was performed by the clergy. Now, one of the good things that was the result of the cathedral synagogue, and I personally happen to like the cathedral synagogue, but one of the good things about it was it helped eliminate ethnic rivalries among Jews. Now, I'm just a Jew who belongs to Eldridge Street, or a Jew who belongs to Beis Medrash HaGadol. I'm not a Glitziana, I'm not a Litvak, I'm not a Russian, a Polish, or this or that, a Hungarian, a Romanian. All the ethnicities within Ashkenazic Judaism, which led to, you know, different shtiebels and different shuls being formed, once you get to the age of cathedral synagogue, that's basically out the window, and you're just a New York Jew. Okay. The chandeliers, the dark wood, the marble floor, the high ceiling, the lush velvet seats, you know what I'm talking about. So there was an attempt to appeal to the American-born children of the immigrants by means of the high synagogue. But the truth of the matter is that the high synagogue actually didn't really appeal to them. The high synagogue mostly appealed to the immigrant themselves, who came at a relatively young age and then matured and made some money in America and now wants a more refined shul. The young people were not attracted to the synagogue at all. That was a big problem. And how do you get the young people involved in religious life? So, this is a question where there are two schools of thought. There are the resistors and the accommodators. My professor, Professor Jeffrey Gurak at YU, famously wrote an article in 1983 about this phenomenon, resistors versus accommodators, that the resistors did not want to have any Americanization of Orthodox Judaism in America, and the accommodators wanted to give people a more Americanized version without compromising the halacha, but the kind of religion that people who were born here would like to associate with, okay? So the two major branches of American Judaism in the 1880s, 1890s, at least of Americanized Judaism, was Reform and Traditional. The Reform is Hebrew Union College, Cincinnati, Temple Emmanuel, CCAR, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. The traditionalists are Jewish Theological Seminary, the Orthodox Union, and the Jewish Endeavor Society. The Jewish Endeavor Society was like the youth movement of the OU. It was established in 1899 and lasted for about a decade. Most of the youth directors were students from Jewish Theological Seminary who went on to have illustrious careers as either conservative or Orthodox rabbis. So if you notice, I'm fudging the difference here between Orthodox and conservative. I'm fudging the difference. because it's one big happy family at that point, at least among the Americanized. Among the Yiddish-speaking recent arrivals, the Greenhorns, so they're in a class by themselves. But the Reform and the Traditionalists, the historicalist school types, they don't even care about the Yiddishists. They say the Yiddishists have no future in this country. There's not going to be a Yiddish Orthodoxy in America, so they think. There's either to be Reform or Conservadox, so to speak. But that's not the way things worked out. How did things work out? That a distinct Orthodoxy, which was not an inclusive coalition of middle-of-the-roaders and Orthodox, but rather was just Orthodox, developed around certain institutions. The Rabbinical Union was the Agudas HaRabbanim, founded in 1902, on the day of Rabbi Jacob Joseph's funeral. So, and the yeshiva would be Reis, Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary, founded in 1897. And that would be immigrant Orthodoxy, trying to preserve the old world in the new world without much Americanization. In the long run, what actually happened? Well, Reitz becomes YU, and YU represents Americanized Orthodoxy, but that's decades into the future. We're not going to get there for a bunch of weeks. Next week, we'll first talk about the beginnings of Reitz and the beginnings of YU when it's still just an immigrant institution. Okay, but in the last few minutes that we have, I want to talk about the career of Jacob Joseph. So already by 1879, there was a desire to have a chief rabbi in New York. And they almost brought to America the Malbim, the famous Malbim, the parish in the Tanakh. But the Malbim, he declined the job, and then he died. So then Yisrael Salanter wanted to send his son to be the chief rabbi. That didn't work out. So in 1887, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Esh, who was the rabbi of Beis Midrash HaGadol, died. And the big synagogues in the Lower East Side said, we need a chief rabbi. We'll cobble together a union of a bunch of shuls, and we'll have a big name. So who's this big name going to be? We need a chacham, a legitimate Talmud chacham, who's going to come from Europe and save Judaism in America. He's going to improve marriage and divorce. He's going to improve kashrus. He's going to improve Talmud Torahs. He's going to do it all. So Yosef, who was a disciple of Yisrael Salanter, who was a rabbi in Vilna, who was a big darshan, known for his oratorical skills, and he was a Zionist too. He was a Mizrahi, he was a Zionist. But the problem is, when he came to America, his kashrus supervision, which was supposed to provide his salary, fell flat. They were proud, people rebelled, they didn't want to pay the tax, and there were competitors who were offering hashgacha, there were competitors who claimed to be chief rabbi, much to his chagrin, so he wasn't the only one who was claiming to be a chief rabbi. So he ended up having a stroke, and the last 7 years of his life, he was an invalid until he died in 1902. In a prior lecture from a few years ago, I mentioned what happened at his funeral. And I'll regal achat, we'll go an extra few minutes. I'll just mention what happened at his funeral. That there was a riot because the Irish from a certain shop on the Lower East Side, on the route towards the boat to the burial site in Brooklyn, threw stuff at the Jews who were passing by. And people were arrested, people were injured. There was a melee, and the police had to get involved. So It happened to be that the people who were involved in that business, the Irish, were people who attended St. Mark's Church. And the St. Mark's Church people sent their wives and children on a boat ride in 1904. And what happened to the boat?
It sunk.
Bingo. The General Slocum fire. The boat sank and many, many people died. And the St. Mark's Church never recovered. And people said it was because they did bad things to the Jews at Yaakov Yosef's funeral.
Right.
What in the long run happened to St. Mark's Church?
It became the Sixth Street Synagogue.
It became the Sixth Street Synagogue, correct, which it still is to this very day. So it's a people don't like telling this story because it's unpleasant and it's not nice. People died. But that's I'm only repeating it because it gets repeated. It's part of of American Jewish history. So Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, was a great man, but he just couldn't make it in America. It just wasn't meant to be. Were there other chief rabbis in other cities? Yes. There was a chief rabbi in St. Louis, a chief rabbi in Boston, a chief rabbi in Pittsburgh, a chief rabbi in Jersey City, in Newark. Mm-hmm. And some of these places, the chief rabbinate was a success. but not in a place like Manhattan. It just couldn't work out that way. Wasn't going to be. Other people claimed to be the chief rabbi of the United States of America. And when they were asked, well, who made you the chief rabbi of America? And the guy said, the sign painter. Okay. So with this, we'll stop. Next time, actually, one more point. 1902 was the year of Yaakov Yosef died. It was the year that Ugudas Rabbanim was founded. It was also the year Salomon Schefter came to America. Salomon Schefter saved JTS. JTS was going to go under. The inclusive conservadox movement was basically floundering. But what ended up happening was that an inclusive conservadoxy, which would still muddle along for another couple of decades at JTS, really diverged. That orthodoxy became more exclusively orthodox via Rietz, and conservative movement became more exclusively conservative via JTS. It wouldn't happen in absolute terms until the 1940s. But already in 1902, in that moment, Schefter's arrival and Agudas Rabbanim's founding, you see, you know, there's machlokes developing. So next week, we're going to spend a session on the Torah, the Talmud Torahs and the early days of Eitz Chaim and of Rietz. And then after that, the week later, we'll discuss some of the ethnic neighborhoods. Okay? See everybody next week. Happy Chanukah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.